The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our radio program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas on the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. Benjamin Quarles, who visited the center recently, is one of America's premier black historians. Dr. Quarles teaches at Morgan State College, where he is a professor of history. Dr. Quarles is a graduate of Shaw University and holds the PhD from the University of Wisconsin. He's written extensively about black history on a variety of topics, including work on Stephen Douglas, John Brown, the anti-slavery movements in the United States in the 19th century, and on blacks in the American Revolution and the Civil War. He's written a documentary history of black Americans. Joining in our discussion is Kent Mulliken, the Assistant Director of the National Humanities Center. Dr. Quarles, it's a pleasure to have you at the center, and welcome to Soundings. I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us about your background and your interest in the study of history.
Well, I became interested in history because when I went to college, they had an exceptional teacher there of history, and I had planned to major really in English or something else, but this teacher was quite unusual. So that after taking one course from her, I decided that I would major in history. The course that I had taken from her, and that determined in part to my career, was a course in Negro history, as it was then called. And this was in the late 1920s, when Negro history was quite suspect as a discipline. And I was very much impressed by the content of the course. I had come from Boston, Massachusetts, where a great deal of American history was made and a great deal of black history was made. The abolitionist crusade centered in Boston for a time under William Lloyd Garrison, and then the revolutionary period in which a black had fallen, the Crispus Attucks and the Boston Massacre. Although I had grown up in Boston, I had not known all of this black component. In fact, going to English High School in Boston, they had a course which we were required to take on the history of Boston. And I had taken a course on the history of Boston and had not come across the black component in Boston's history. So I was quite astounded to take this general course in black history under this teacher and find out that blacks in Boston had made an impact on Boston history. And therefore, I became confirmed in the field of black history. When I went on to do graduate work at the University of Wisconsin, I was very fortunate in being permitted by my major professor, Dr. William B. Heseltine, to do my dissertation topic on a black of the 19th century, the outstanding single black, perhaps the most talked about, was Frederick Douglass. And generally in this early period, major professors frowned on any black subject, but he permitted me to do that, to work on Frederick Douglass, an outstanding 19th century black, and that simply confirmed my interest in black history. So that as a result of two great teachers, both of them happened to be white, but they both knew a great deal about black history, I became interested in the field, and when I went back to predominantly black colleges to teach, naturally I was permitted to teach black history, so that my whole career was very fortunate in having met two teachers and having been in a teaching atmosphere where you were permitted to teach a course which until the last 10 or 15 years was highly suspect in academic circles.
Could you tell us something about how one does find source material in black history?
Yes, it's an excellent point, because generally in black history, many of the materials are scattered. They're fugitive. They're not readily come by. Mainly in the antebellum period, one goes through the abolitionist newspapers, papers like William Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator, papers like the Anti-Slavery Standard, papers like the Pennsylvania Freeman. All of these were papers which were produced weeklies by antebellum, by abolitionist societies, those dedicated to the overthrow of slavery. Now, invariably, they would carry notices about blacks in their papers, so that one of the great sources is to comb those anti-slavery papers for their references to blacks, because they were anxious to show that blacks who were free were able to accomplish something. They were able to show that the black was not meant to be a slave, and they attacked slavery, but they also carried information about free blacks. Now, free blacks themselves, from the very beginning, were interested in expressing themselves. So that in 1827 we get the first black newspaper, Freedom's Journal, that's a weekly. So that before the antebellum period was over, there were some 28 or 29 newspapers, many of them fugitive, lasting just a year or two, but they were brought out by blacks in the North. And therefore, for example, the great Frederick Douglass himself, whom I mentioned, 1847, he brought out, started a weekly called the North Star. 4 years later, he had become so famous that he entitled his paper, with all due modesty, Frederick Douglass's Weekly. Now, if you go through those papers, you see those deal almost exclusively with the black experience, with what other blacks were doing, what black writers were doing. They give you a picture of black ambitions, black outlooks, black reactions to national and local events. And then there were black convention movements starting in 1830. Blacks in the North would meet annually in a national movement, and there they would discuss opportunities, problems, plights, ways out. And then there were many state conventions. Blacks in a given state would hold annual conventions, and they managed to get many of these published, so that this is the kind of material. Another final kind is simply the papers of great abolitionists like William Lloyd Garrison or Wendell Phillips, to go through their papers and read their references to blacks. So a great repository like the Boston Public Library, which has the papers of these great abolitionists, or in Cornell, where they have great papers of the New York abolitionists such as Gerrit Smith and others. There's where you'd find references to blacks that whites made, and they knew some of these blacks quite well. They traveled with them. So that there is a body of information that you actually can, a primary source material that you can actually trace the activities of these antebellum blacks. Now, the antebellum blacks were active in the South, too, but they did not have the elbow room. For example, one of the great works that has come out in the last 5 or 6 years is a book by a man named Dr. Ira Berlin. It's called Slaves Without Masters, The Free Negro in the South. Now, there was a great body of blacks in the South who were free. At the beginning of the Civil War, there were approximately 500,000 free blacks in the United States. Half of those free blacks were in the South. The other half were in the North, obviously. But I have not concentrated on the free blacks in the South because, as Berlin said, they did not have the elbow room. They were under constant surveillance. They were a third element, as U.B. Phillips said, they were a third element in a society meant for two, the master and the slave. Hence, they were under constant watch in many places. They had to have a white guardian who would speak up for them no matter how eminent they had become in black circles. They could not participate politically at all. They had no newspapers. Their church services were carefully scrutinized because thought they would have a bad influence on the slave. So one of the reasons that I've concentrated on the free black in the North is that he only amounted to, the free blacks amounted to less than 2% of the population in the North, and hence they did not pose a threat, and hence they were given freedom to speak as they wanted, to publish, to agitate as they wanted. Now, in the South, where the black population was 34% of the total, you couldn't grant the free black that freedom, because not only was the black population numerous, but you had here a population of slaves that the free black would probably do business with him, make him intoxicated or something, put ideas in his head. So that in the South, I have not dealt, although Berlin and others have gone extensively into the South, there is much more that you could write about in the North, because there's so much more that blacks were able to do: participate in politics, write, publish, travel, lecture, speak. There were no anti-slavery societies in the South after 1830, after William Lloyd Garrison started agitating, after Nat Turner's famous insurrection in Southampton County, and after a black militant named David Walker published an appeal in which he urged the slaves to rise and strike their masters if necessary. After 1830, the South, which up to that time had had abolition societies, simply barred all, they closed ranks. And therefore, if a black wanted to express himself, or even if a white, many white liberals had to either go in silence, or like the Grimke sisters, simply leave the South and come North. So that the South became closed to anything except the pro-slavery argument. And hence, if you're going to deal with blacks as contributors to thought, as agitators and that, you almost have to deal with those blacks in the North.
I've heard you speak recently about the problem of objectivity in history, and undoubtedly many of the source materials that you've used are surrounded by a clamor of controversy. How do you tune your ear to hear the truth amidst that clamor of controversy?
Yes, that's an excellent point. What one does is try to see what motivates a person. When we deal with the white abolitionists, for example, these men were quite outstanding, quite outspoken. They courted danger even in the North by mobs who didn't want agitation at all on such an issue as slavery. Now, one of the great questions is, what was the motivation of these white abolitionists? There is a school of thought that says that these men were themselves disturbed in some way. They had lost their position as elite groups. They were striving for status. They were themselves, in some ways, mentally disturbed, and that's why they became reformers. So that you have an interpretation of these reformers as people who were not interested in blacks as such, but they were solving some inner need, and they took out their inner needs by becoming agitators and abolitionists. Now, there's another school of thought which more recently has come into existence, which says that if you're a reformer, it indicates that you are psychologically whole. There's something whole about a person or a group that is interested in helping a fellow man or in righting a wrong. So the one of the things is, what moved these people to be, even after you read the documents which clearly reveal that they're reformers, then there is always a question of motivation. Now, most of us deal very gingerly with that because there are no documents. This man can't tell you exactly why. He might think he knows why he was an abolitionist. So there is that sense of objectivity. But in a more direct sense, there is always a question as to, you have to try to read into a statement or read into a movement some of the things which you think it meant, which you believe it meant to these people at that particular time. Granting, of course, that they worked in the limitations of what they knew at that time. For example, when you read about these white abolitionists, most of them did believe that blacks were innately inferior. They were creatures of their own day. They were subject to some of the limitations of knowledge that we have today. But they were tremendous reformers because they believed that even though the black might be inferior in some respects, this did not mean that his rights should be denied or attenuated or he should be a lesser citizen. So that interpreting these great white abolitionists, Philip Sell, there's a whole galaxy of them, of Birney and John Brown, and you could go on, there was always this question of their motivation, and then no matter how great they were, there were some beliefs which they had which were typical of their time, and you try to see them against their time.
From the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, Ideas in Circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
I'm talking now with Dr. Benjamin Quarles of Morgan State College about blacks and American history and society, and about the teaching and writing of black American history. Joining in the discussion is Kent Mulliken, the Assistant Director of the National Humanities Center. Dr. Quarles, let's turn now to your views on blacks and American writing and fiction.
Well, I think that most of the writers in American history have tended to portray the black as a humorous figure, almost as a foil. They almost have the minstrel attitude toward the black, so that they see him as a figure, as a typically humorous figure, a buffoon in many respects, so that in much of American literature until recently, you see the black portrayed in a clownish way, you see, in a way that that suggests the minstrel stereotype, the using of words incorrectly, the pomposity of a black preacher, so that he becomes a sort of local color figure, but also a semi-humorous figure, and this particularly emerges in Southern literature and Southern fiction. Now, the black is generally not seen as a militant figure in our fiction, so this is one of the things that now, as we begin to look at the institution of slavery as it's now studied by the scholars, we see a great deal of militancy, which is not on the surface, which is undetected, which is the everyday resistance to slavery, the breaking of tools, the slowing down, the feigning of illness, any number of subtle devices which were protest devices and not acceptance. But it was necessary for a certain master class to believe that the slave was docile and the slave was humorous and the slave couldn't take care of himself, and much of that is reflected in the writing of the persons who wrote fiction, because even a relatively liberal such as Twain and others tend to see the black in terms of a stereotype. So I think the greatest thing that blacks have feared, not only in history but in fiction too, and particularly in fiction, as the stereotype, a black is seen as a stereotype. Now, the more we get into black life, we realize that a stereotype thing simply is not indicative of black life. For example, if we take before the Civil War, there were four or five different levels of black society and a free black in the South. For example, we'd have some free blacks who owned slaves, and we'd have some free blacks who were of the artisan class. We'd have some who were domestics and some who were hangers-on in white establishments. So that the black has been a very complex figure. But in our literature, we tend to see him as a one-dimensional figure. Sometimes we may see him as a symbol of evil because of blackness or something. So that the heart of darkness, the sort of Conrad thing, in which a man like Conrad, a great fiction writer, gives us a picture of Africa that most people still believe is Africa. Now, they don't look at African writings, they don't look at the African himself, but the heart of darkness. Here a man is dealing in fiction, but the fiction people have had such a tremendous hold that we tend to think of Idi Amin, we're almost equating him with the whole concept that we got from a great writer like Conrad. So that these fiction writers have had a great influence on our conception of blacks in general, you see. And they're tremendous people. For example, as you know, blacks have bitterly objected to William Stryon's The Confessions of Nat Turner, which is a tremendous work, and Stryon says, this is just a work of my own mind, imagination. But in the first place, they say, well, Stryon shouldn't get in that anyhow. This should be done by a black. In the second place, the stereotype of Nat Turner loving a white woman, which is here again a stereotype, you see. And Nat Turner's own mysticism, his own prophetic vision, they claim Stryon doesn't bring that out. Now, here's a great contemporary work. In fact, the blacks were so opposed to it that, as you know, although Stryon was paid perhaps $500,000 for the motion picture rights, there's no motion picture ever been produced. No black actor would take the role. The black community was so against it because they said this was a fictional misrepresentation of one of their great heroes, Nat Turner, see. Now, this may not be so. The other writers have said, no, this is an actual, what Stryon was doing was showing the man's humanity. All men are not gods. In turn, this was an angle. But after all, Stryon says, this is what I, Stryon, am doing. You see, I don't say this is history, you see. But nevertheless, a man like Stryon, the only difficulty is he has tremendous influence. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the image that he sets of Nat Turner will be an image that most people will get. They won't get the counter-image. And this is where fiction is so important.
In a recent book, he has equated slavery with the Holocaust.
Yes.
In Sophie's Choice. What's your reaction to that as a historian? Do you think that's apples and oranges?
Yes, I don't think that that's quite true. Most blacks say that they object to the famous Sambo personality of the famous writer, you know, Stanley Elkins, who said that the black had been a slave so long that he had internalized his position. He'd been expected to behave like a Sambo, and the Sambo means fawning, servile, master, bowing and scraping. That's what Elkin defines as a Sambo personality. Now he says the slave had been required to play that role, and he played it so well that he became a true Sambo. He internalized his role. Now, Elkin doesn't have any sources for that, so he makes an analogy. He says, now look at, this is the way the Jews in Germany became. They were infantilized, and just like, now the great difference is that the slave was not a Jew in Germany. The slave was needed. The slave, you had to use the stick, but you had to use the carrot. He was part of the extended family in many respects. There was a symbiotic relationship as well as an antagonistic relationship. There was an identification. He was a worker. You had to get him to do work. And therefore, you had to behave in a certain way. And he never became a true Sambo. And therefore, Elkin is wrong. And to compare him with the Jew under the Holocaust is wholly erroneous because they say, when the Civil War broke out, look at these 180,000 blacks who became soldiers. Over two-thirds of them were Southern slaves who joined the Union armies and who fought well. Now, if they had been true Sambos, once they had a chance to wear the gun, you say, to put on a uniform, they know, see, so that the Sambo personality has been greatly denied. In fact, Elkin has not really pursued that since he originally made it. But that is where you see the Holocaust identification.
When you were a young graduate student and a young scholar working on your first books, you were working a relatively untilled field, and you had all the advantages and the disadvantages of that kind of work. What does a young graduate student and a young scholar working in the field face today? How does today's black history differ?
I think today's black history differs in the respect that those who worked in the pioneer field, great Carter G. Woodson and others, were anxious to prove that there was a body of legitimate information that would stand scrutiny. And that this was not, the whole field was not propaganda masquerading as history. So that the pioneers always have to say, to establish something and say, now there's this legitimate body of information that will stand historical investigation. Here are the sources. Here are where the bodies are buried. Here are the statistics. Here are the tables. Here are the references to blacks. This is the kind of documentation we use. So that the first great pioneer like Carter G. Woodson was anxious to get on the record the role of the blacks. He had to prove it. You were under necessity to prove something because the whole field was suspect, and it is still suspect in some quarters. It serves, they think, a social need rather than an intellectual need. There is still some suspicion. Now, the younger historians, however, and the people coming on the scene now do not have that burden of proof. You don't have to prove anything. It's now accepted everywhere in the better major institutions. Now they have these specialists in black studies and minority studies. Now this means that since you're no longer under the necessity of establishing a body of information, since it's granted that it's out there, it's only to be dug up, now you're freer to engage in interpretation, in analogy, in comparison. You're free to say what this means. Some of us just told a story. We were, fortunately for me, when I came along, I was able to tell a story because that was the only ability really I had. I had no insight. Sometimes a student would ask me a question in a class, and I'd been teaching the subject for years, and I'd say, my God, this student has a good mind. That question never occurred to me. Never occurred to me because my mind was pedestrian. I was following the facts. You're putting them together. You're organized. Now the younger historians come and say, yes, all of this facts has been established. Now what did this mean? What was the significance of this man? What was his inner life? See? So they're able now to, they don't have to establish that this man did something. Now they're able to get into more complex things about insights into the man, insights into the period. They're able now to really venture into the higher reaches of history. What does all of this mean? Now, first you have to establish the body of facts. Now that you don't have to establish them, you can become an interpretive historian rather than a descriptive and narrative historian.
I wonder if you could follow that up and comment about Francis Fitzgerald's new book on the teaching of American history.
This book is a great book because tells us on the public school level, where you had to take this in the elementary and high schools in the last century, the shifting emphasis in the field of American history. In fact, your book is called America Revised, meaning that you revise. Now, each generation, therefore, under school boards, under state boards, have emphasized different approaches, different techniques, different even disciplines in the field of public education. And Frances Fitzgerald, who's still relatively young, says, the history that she studied 25 years ago, where is it gone? Because there's so much change. And it's changed because, of course, social studies, other things have been injected with history, behavioral sciences. In fact, history has really become sort of a handmaiden, not a discipline in its own right, but they bring in history now when they're discussing problems. If they're discussing the tariff or something, they might bring in the history of the tariff. So history, instead of having an integrity of its own, in the last stage is the social studies emphasis stage, which is the present day stage. It now has become so interspersed with the social studies that the only time you meet history as history is when it introduces a phase of juvenile delinquency, let us say, or welfare. Then you go back to and trace it a thing historically. But you don't treat history as we would have studied it.
You've been listening to Soundings, Ideas in Circulation, in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Director of the center is Bill Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Please join us this week for Soundings and a conversation with Dr. Benjamin Quarles of Morgan State University. Dr. Quarles is one of America's prominent historians, and this week on Soundings, he explores black history and culture in America in the 19th and 20th centuries. I hope you'll listen for a conversation with Dr. Benjamin Quarles, scholar and historian, on Soundings.